Circle A has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Back to Back Cafe, a worker-owned collective featuring fair trade, shade-grown organic coffee, pastries, and vegetarian food. Back to Back Cafe is open Monday through Saturday and is located at 6th and East Burnside. More information at 503-233-1929. And now, here's Circle A.
Growing up, I used to worry about the day I dropped the bomb.
Blow up my house, my dad and my mom.
Every time the sky would turn a funny shade of green,
I thought they dropped the bomb.
Then the media told us not to worry anymore, that there wasn't any threat of a nuclear war. Everybody just forgot. Everybody just forgot about it.
In the 1980s, the anti-nuclear issue was in the forefront of activist consciousness in the light of Reagan-era nuclear weapons buildup. Today, with wars waged due to alleged weapons of mass destruction and an increasingly arrogant stance on non-proliferation by the Bush administration, nuclear weapons at home and abroad are once again becoming part of the popular dialogue. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll be speaking to anti-nuclear activists, past and present, while learning about the United States government's plans to resume large-scale nuclear weapons manufacturing. Stay tuned for Circle A Radio.
This is Dr. Robert Siviak. He is a physicist and the former budget manager of the Department of Energy's National Security Program. He's the author of a new report called The Reliable Replacement Warhead Program, A Slippery Slope to New Nuclear Weapons.
I actually work at the Office of Management and Budget, overseeing the budget of the Department of Energy's national security programs. So I was employed by the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, but my portfolio, so to speak, was to look at the Department of Energy's national security program. From 1989 to 99, mostly I got frustrated being in Washington. In the early part of my tenure, I mean, I saw my job as trying to cut the budget for the nuclear weapons program. Actually, under George Bush's father, I had some success. But Bill Clinton had difficulties taking on the defense establishment, and really the budget started just going up and up and up. It was very frustrating that I thought it was a big waste and I couldn't do anything about it. Since then, it's gotten much worse under George W. Bush. One of the interesting things about the reliable replacement warhead is that it's different things to different people, and so it's a little hard for me to say exactly what it is. What the weapons laboratories would like to do is to design new nuclear warheads that they believe will be more reliable and cheaper to maintain than existing warheads, but they would like to replace every warhead in the existing nuclear weapons stockpile. We've got about 6,000 warheads in the stockpile right now, and the weapons laboratories would like to design a whole host of new designs to replace all those warheads. What Congress thinks they're funding is a much more narrow program to upgrade existing warheads. There are some warheads that are now approaching 25 years old in the stockpile, and there are concerns. I mean, there are certain components that are limited life components, and they've always been viewed as such. The Department of Energy routinely replaces those components, things like batteries and supplies of tritium and neutron generators. But any component, in some sense, has a limited lifetime, whether it's 10 years or 100 years or 1,000 years. Things eventually get old and wear out and may become suspect. What the Department of Energy does is they take apart 11 warheads of every single type every year and examine them and look at their components and see if they're still functioning properly and try and anticipate any problems. And if there are problems, they replace the problem components when that's necessary. And that's one way to maintain the warheads. Unfortunately, for the last 10 years or so, they've not only been doing that, but they've been upgrading components to add new capabilities. And this reliable replacement warhead program would really be a step up to the next level of upgrading and completely redesigning warheads. One of the concerns is the plutonium in the nuclear warhead, which is the so-called pit of the nuclear warhead, or the primary stage of the warhead. Plutonium is radioactive, and that means it decays and turns into something else. And so there's a concern that plutonium may not have the same properties and behave the same after a number of years. It turns out that the half-life of plutonium is 25,000 years, roughly, which means about one out of every 50,000 atoms decays in any given year. So it's a very small amount of the plutonium that's decaying, but in principle that could change the properties of the weapon in a very fundamental way. The Department of Energy has studied that and determined that the lifetime should be at least 60 years and could be much longer. The concerns of aging are legitimate, but one way to address that is to continue or expand this the surveillance program that they currently conduct to examine components and replace them when necessary. There's something called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which about 195 nations have signed, pretty much all but a handful of nations in the world have signed this Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And that treaty designates five nuclear powers, the United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France. All the other nations that are signatory to that treaty have promised not to develop nuclear weapons in exchange for the right to develop civilian nuclear power and assistance if they need it in their civilian nuclear programs. The other part of that is that the five nuclear powers have agreed that they would move towards eventual disarmament. There's actually strict language that requires them to be proceeding towards disarmament. And that's the bargain, that the five nuclear weapons powers would reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons in exchange for the other nations not developing them. And that's the basic structure under which nonproliferation occurs. And there are at least three nations that have not signed the treaty that have developed nuclear weapons, and that's Israel, India, and Pakistan. There's two other nations that are currently major nations of concern that everybody knows about. It's North Korea and Iran. North Korea has pulled out of the treaty and says that they are now free to do whatever they want. Iran is still a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and there's continuing negotiations on what their rights and responsibilities are under that treaty.
So the ramifications of being a part of the treaty and not complying are higher than not being a part of the treaty. And
yes, paradoxically, right. That's true. Although being part of the treaty is supposed to be allow you to get certain nuclear cooperation, which you can't get if you're outside the treaty. But there are things like if you're a treaty signatory and you're not living up to your responsibilities, there's provisions for sanctions against nations that do that. Whereas if you're outside the treaty, there's really no prohibition against doing what you want. Every single president, up to George W. Bush, has signed a major nuclear weapons arms control treaty. The Bush administration claims that they're reducing weapons, and it's a very narrow construct that allows them to claim that. But they do claim that they're reducing the numbers of nuclear weapons because they're reducing the number of deployed strategic nuclear weapons while they're keeping thousands of weapons in an active stockpile. In some sense, they are reducing the numbers of nuclear weapons, but they're not reducing them very quickly. Of more concern, and that's what I address in my report, is the fact that they are moving towards the development of new nuclear weapons. President Clinton signed the Nuclear Weapons Test Ban Treaty, which said that we wouldn't test nuclear weapons. This administration so far has lived up to that treaty. They haven't yet tested nuclear weapons, but their programs to design new nuclear weapons and bring them into the stockpile really increases the danger that at some point the United States might feel like it has to test. If new warheads are introduced into the stockpile, it's very likely the Department of Defense would want them to be tested before they rely upon them. The Department of Energy is saying that that's what they're going to examine under the Reliable Replacement Warhead Program. Their goal is to design a warhead that won't need to be tested, but I really think that that's kind of a bait and switch. You know, 10 years down the road when there's a new warhead, and they say, well, we haven't been maintaining the existing warhead that it's supposed to replace as well as we might because we were anticipating that it would be replaced with this new warhead, but we're not sure about this new warhead. We need to test it because it's so important to our defense. It would be very difficult for Congress to say no. So I think Congress should just say no before the program gets started because there's absolutely no need to design new nuclear weapons. As I said earlier, quite straightforward to maintain the warheads we have by replacing components as they age and when there's an issue with the ability to keep performing as they were designed to, they can be replaced with exactly the same copies of their original design or as near as to their original design as possible. And that's the cheapest, simplest, most direct, most reliable, and safest way to maintain the stockpile. There's no question in my mind that what the majority of Congress thinks that they're funding and what the laboratories and the Department of Energy want to do is vastly different. I think that it is still early, and I think the issue will be looked at much more closely this year. When they provided the initial funding, it was all very unclear where the program was headed, but the budget requests for the nuclear weapons builders and the Department of Energy this year mentions the reliable warhead, replacement warhead, nearly 100 times, and it's very clear that they're looking upon that as the key to the future of the nuclear weapons stockpile and not a minor program to upgrade existing warheads.
What do you think would be the ramifications globally if we came up with this new warhead and we decided to test it?
If the United States tested a nuclear weapon, I'm sure that other nations, particularly Russia and China and France, for that matter, that have signed this treaty that had active testing programs before the treaty would be pretty upset that their nuclear weapons builders would be pushing to test their warheads very aggressively and that their governments probably would agree to that. And so we'd have a return to nuclear weapons testing and perhaps a renewed arms race for no rational reason at all. If there's one superpower acting as a Cold War power developing new nuclear weapons and testing them, I can't imagine other nations would sit by the sidelines.
Dr. Robert Siviak. His report is called The Reliable Replacement Warhead Program, A Slippery Slope to New Nuclear Weapons. This is Lulina Miles of Tri-Valley Cares, which stands for Tri-Valley Communities Against a Radioactive Environment. They're located in the Bay Area.
We work locally, nationally, and internationally in order to change U.S. nuclear policy. We are part of coalitions. Internationally, we work with a group called Abolition 2000, and there are more than 2,000 organizations that are members of that. They're located all over the world and every continent on Earth. Our united goal is that we all work together to get rid of nuclear weapons. In the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, which is a U.S. organization, it's filled with groups who are in the shadow of nuclear weapons facilities across the U.S. So we get together, and every year we actually go to Washington, D.C., for something called DC Days, and that's the time when we actually lobby Congress. It's an awesome opportunity to take citizens who just care about these issues, who are not paid lobbyists, and have them walk into congressional offices, because congressional offices are so overwhelmed with paid lobbyists and the vested interests of people who are working for different corporations. Other things that we do, we have a newsletter that helps us to work with local people. And the fact that we are located so close to the Livermore Lab has given us an edge in terms of our work because we are within the district of, you know, the city of Livermore. We're within the same congressional officials district as the laboratory itself. And so we're coming from a really authentic place when we're lobbying on issues and when we're commenting or when we want to challenge something in court. It's easy to get standing to challenge because we're directly impacted. And so that's helped that we've always maintained headquarters really close to the laboratory itself. I got involved with this organization in 1994 because I was protesting against spent nuclear fuel rod shipments through the Concord Naval Weapons Station. And at that time, I met the executive director here, Mary Leah Kelly. There were public hearings in Concord. and the Department of the Navy was there, and they were presenting with the Department of Energy. And I was actually working with the Navy because I was on this board called the Restoration Advisory Board. We oversaw the cleanup of the Superfund sites out at the Concord Naval Weapons Station. And I was the youngest member on that board. I was in high school at the time. And they told me, the Navy, a couple officials, the Navy told me during a Restoration Advisory Board meeting that the actual shipments that were coming through were not the high-level waste that the Department of Energy claimed the need for the program was, because they needed to get high-level nuclear fuel rod waste out of foreign research reactors, but it was actually going to be the lower-level waste. And the waste that is not as useful for producing bomb material. The justification for the whole program was to ensure that bomb material would not be in the hands of, you know, foreign countries that didn't have nuclear weapons programs or legitimate nuclear weapons programs. So they went ahead and they told us a lie to get us to agree to them bringing this stuff through. And I had gotten this piece of information that it wasn't true. And so I got up at the hearing and I asked the Department of Energy if they could tell me if it was actually only high-level waste that was going to come through. And they were really thrown off by the question. And that was just the first of a number of lies that were connected to the program that I would learn throughout the years. A few years ago, we put in some Freedom of Information Act requests to find out about shipments that they had planned from Rocky Flats, Colorado, to Livermore. It was shipments of plutonium. I was pouring through all these documents, and I found out that the Department of Energy had given themselves a national security exemption from the federal transportation standards around shipping containers. And these containers that they were going to ship in, that they had now approved, would not pass the crush test. That means that the plutonium would be a lot more vulnerable on highways if there was an impact that involved a crush, which is a pretty common accident scenario. So because we got this information, we ended up going to the Earth Justice group of environmental lawyers in Oakland, and they represented us and sued the Department of Energy. And within months, the Department of Energy had withdrawn its approval to go forward with this plant, and they weren't going to ship any of the plutonium from Colorado to Livermore. Livermore Laboratory is about 40 miles east of San Francisco. The Livermore Lab actually says that the environment that's going to have most impacts from it releases are a 50-mile radius. So there's actually 7 million people within a 50-mile radius of the laboratory. Inside of the site, there are more than 10,000 employees, and the annual budget of the Livermore Lab is about $1 billion. About 80% of the work is directly nuclear weapons work, and less than 1% is actually renewable energy research. But they nevertheless do talk about that in their public relations materials. I think over the next few years, the amount of nuclear weapons work is going to increase and the budget will increase. A lot of the work that's going on right now at Livermore is plutonium pit design work. The pit is the core of a modern nuclear weapon. It's in classified shapes, but it's made out of plutonium, which is radioactive, and it has a half-life of 24,000 years, and so it's estimated to be hazardous for 240,000 years. One microscopic particle of this material, if lodged in your lungs, can cause cancer. It's also very difficult to store properly. In some forms, it's pyrophoric, or it can ignite upon contact with oxygen, and it also can go critical if you store too much of it in one space. So a lot of the work that they're doing is actually redesigning the core of nuclear weapons, or ensuring that current nuclear weapons cores will work effectively. And so they end up with a lot of plutonium waste through that process. Something that has a lot to do with the reliable replacement warhead is the fact that Livermore and Los Alamos are both increasing their plutonium work. So the U.S. Nuclear Weapons design capabilities are really improving. Right now, they have the fastest supercomputer in the world here at Livermore Lab, and that is exclusively for nuclear weapons work. Additionally, they're going forward with the National Ignition Facility, and this is the largest laser project that's going to have a thermonuclear explosion inside it. It'll be the first thermonuclear explosion ever in world history inside of a laboratory setting. There have been thermonuclear explosions before on Earth, but only inside nuclear weapons. And you also find those kind of explosions inside the sun. So now they want to have that in a laboratory setting, and that's going to give them the capability to really look in detail at every aspect of the actual nuclear weapon explosion. And that project is going to cost about $5 billion just to build this National Ignition Facility. There's a competition between Livermore and Los Alamos on whose design for the reliable replacement warhead will win. At the United Nations last year, we went to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, and countries all over the world were talking about the U.S. nuclear weapons program and about the robust nuclear earth penetrator and all the money that the U.S. has been pouring into nuclear weapons. I mean, right now we're spending 1.5 times what we were spending average dollars during the Cold War, even adjusted for inflation. And that really sends a strong message to the rest of the world that nuclear weapons are the cornerstone of U.S. foreign military policy, and that you really need to either join the nuclear club or you're going to end up being potentially threatened. The Hiroshima mayor, Akiba, he was quoted as saying that the egocentric worldview of the U.S. government is reaching extremes.
That was Lulina Miles of Tri-Valley Cares. Their website is trivalleycares.org. TRIVALLEYCARES.org.
On June 2nd, 1987, in the early morning, Katya Kamasurik, a peace activist from the San Francisco Bay Area, walked through an unlocked gate, leaving cookies and a bouquet of flowers for security guards, and entered a satellite control facility named Navstar at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in Santa Barbara County, California. Once inside, she used a hammer, crowbar, and cordless electric drill to damage panels of an IBM mainframe computer and a satellite dish on top of the building. Using a crowbar, she removed the computer's chipboards and danced on them. On the wall, she spray-painted Nuremberg, International Law, and Statements for Disarmament. After being undetected for 2 hours, she left the base and hitchhiked to San Francisco. The next morning, she held a press conference at the federal building in San Francisco to explain her action, whereupon she was taken into custody by the FBI. She was charged with sabotage and destruction of government property. Kamasurik's work was a plowshares action, one of many individuals and community members who have entered military bases and weapons facilities and have symbolically and actually disarmed components of U.S. first strike nuclear weapons systems, as well as combat helicopters and other conventional weapons. People who have been involved in plowshares actions have undertaken a process of intense spiritual preparation, nonviolence training, and community formation, and have given careful consideration to the risks involved. Plowshares activists, accepting full responsibility for their actions, remain the site of their action so they can publicly explain their witness.
Most people are familiar with GPS, the Global Positioning System, and GPS is the civilian side of Navstar. And Navstar is the targeting system used for nuclear weapons. In fact, it was developed for using nuclear weapons because the bombs that we have to be landed directly on target to work. Most of the key targets from the standpoint of a nuclear first strike are missiles in their silos and underground command centers, and these things are protected by tons and tons of concrete. So unless the missile is dropped directly on top of the bunker or the missile silo, it doesn't do any good. So that means you need really, really, really pinpoint targeting. And that's hard, especially if you imagine missiles coming from the United States, flying all the way over to what was then the Soviet Union, tiny fractions off course magnify over that distance, you know, and turn into miles of error. To keep things on target, they have to have in-flight correction, and that's what Navistar was developed for. The idea actually came up in 1958, if you can imagine, is when they started working on it. It was realized that you needed some type of really great navigation system that would allow for these in-flight corrections in order to get our missiles this accurate. And of course, it took many years for it to develop. It wasn't until the 80s that they got it online, as it were, satellites orbiting the Earth that would send the signals and allow for this type of navigation. If you can't get the missile on target, there's no point in using it. That's why the navigation system is kind of the linchpin of our first strike capability. And the satellites that send the signal have to be kept very carefully coordinated on their flight paths, and with their clocks have to be constantly kept accurate. And we have, the military, I should say, has computers that do that. The computers are now in Colorado Springs, Colorado. But previously, they were at Vandenberg Air Force Base and also in Hawaii. I'm sure there would have been neater ways to do it, but I used a large crowbar myself. I'd been doing martial arts beforehand, and I found that, you know, letting out a good yell from the diaphragm while smacking the computer was very effective. It was even fun dressing up for it. One of the people who advised me, who'd done Plasher's action, or two or three herself, said, you know, it's a dangerous thing to do because the soldiers or the security people might panic and shoot you. And obviously that's never happened to a Plasher's activist, but it's something that we have to think about. So she suggested that I dress festively, so in order to put the military people, the soldiers, at ease. She said, you know, why don't you wear a clown suit or put flowers in your hair or something like that? And I said, no, I can't do that. I have to hike onto this military base. This is serious. I wasn't planning to wear camouflage exactly, but, you know, I was wearing a watch cap and put soot on my face and, you know, I was on a mission. So she said, nonetheless, you really need to think about how people are going to see you. They're going to be very frightened and they might panic and pull the trigger. So I was trying to think what I could do to, you know, keep these hypothetical soldiers from panicking. So what I did was I brought a big bouquet of flowers, red, white, and blue flowers, and a box of Mrs. Field's chocolate chip cookies, and I set these at the entrance to the compound where I was working. See, the computer was on a hilltop, and the hilltop was encircled by a high chain-link fence with barbed wire on top, with big swinging gates. And I locked the gates so that when the soldiers in their jeeps came riding up, they'd have to unlock the gate. I locked it with a kryptonite lock and put some epoxy in it. And I stuck the red, white, and blue bouquet in it, and I put out the box of cookies, thinking at least they'll have to stop and defuse the box, thinking it was, you know, they'll think it's a bomb, not cookies. And I left this greeting card with a kitten on it. It was a blank greeting card, and inside I wrote, I have no guns. You must have lots. Let's not be hasty. No cheap shots. Have a cookie and a nice day. Katya. And then I went in and broke into the building and destroyed the computer. What surprised me, among other things, was that the alarm system failed. Because when I did get into the building, I found the box with big fuse box type affair pertaining to the alarm system. And the switches were all flipped, but nobody came. So apparently it malfunctioned, which is why I was able to spend hours in there. I tried to climb up into an upper story, and there was a big radar dish about the size of a queen-size bed, which I dented. I finished what I had to do. I ate my snack, and then I thought, I can't just sit here and wait. So I put myself together, and I hiked back out, and I went up to San Francisco to the surprise of my friends, and they wrote a press release and distributed it, and I held a press conference. And the FBI showed up at some point during the press conference and arrested me. But you see, it hadn't been planned as the sort of thing you walk away from, especially not what with the card and the fingerprints and the rest of it. And although, you know, I could have not turned myself in, didn't really want to live underground. Of course, I haven't tried living underground, but I've read about it. It seemed to me I'd rather pay as you go. The federal prosecutor asked the judge to forbid me to say anything about international law or first strike weapons, or the economics of the arms race, or even that the computer I destroyed was part of the first strike weapon system. so all the jurors ever found out was that I destroyed a computer, and they had no idea why or what the computer was for. The judge gave me this list of forbidden words, including the words for strike, nuclear missile, Geneva Convention, Nuremberg Principles. It was quite a lot like one of those bad dreams that you have where you're trying to yell for help or shout a warning and no sound comes out. I was sentenced to 5 years in prison. I did somewhat over 2 years, and I actually got out early owing to an arithmetic mistake on the part of the parole officer who calculated my time. I think he shaved about 12 or 13 months off my sentence by dropping a zero. I watched him do it. He was doing the math in the margin of this form he was filling out, and he made a little mistake, which was turned out to be very beneficial. I took the LSAT while I was in prison and applied to various law schools, and well, I got into Harvard Law School and out of prison the same week.
Komisarek works with the Just Cause Law Collective, a nonprofit Oakland, California law firm that specializes in defending and advising protesters engaged in civil disobedience tactics. She's perhaps best known for her successful defense of hundreds of demonstrators arrested during the 1999 World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle. For more information, visit www.lawcollective.org.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland.
When they do, you're gonna be dead.
Tonight we are talking about what's happened in the anti-nuclear movement since it was one of the issues in the forefront of activists' consciousness. Stay tuned. This is Michael Mariette, the executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Nuclear Information and Resource Service was founded in 1978 to be the information and networking center for the grassroots movement against nuclear power and for sustainable energy. The anti-nuclear movement has really been a locally based movement, very decentralized. The reason NIRS was formed was because this was a very decentralized movement. It didn't have a national presence, really, and NIRS was formed to try to coordinate the work of all the different grassroots groups and try to get the information from Washington, you know, from the Congress and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the various other agencies, you know, and get that information out to this movement. Through our affiliation with World Information Service on Energy, we now have offices in Washington, Amsterdam, Ukraine, Russia, and several other countries. So we're really a worldwide organization working on the whole gamut of nuclear power and radioactive waste and sustainable energy issues. Currently, our major focus is the fact that for the first time in some 30 years, there is a serious possibility of new nuclear reactor construction in the U.S., and that's due to primarily the efforts of George Bush, who is very clearly the most ardently pro-nuclear president in history, and Congress, which has been much more pro-nuclear than past Congresses. Last year, an energy bill was passed that provides about up to about $13 billion of taxpayer money to help the nuclear power industry out by in building new reactors. So right now we have, across the country, 12 new reactor projects that have been announced, but we're expecting that to happen as early as the end of this year or sometime next year. Clearly one of our major focuses right now is working to prevent that.
Can you talk about the relationship between the environmental and anti-war focus within the anti-nuclear movement?
There's a couple of areas where there's overlap. One of the key ones is in the use of depleted uranium weaponry. Depleted uranium is a byproduct of uranium enrichment process for commercial power, and the waste product of these plants is tremendously large in terms of volume and extremely toxic in terms of effect. The material is uranium hexafluoride. It is both radioactive and chemically hazardous, and there is no place to dispose of it currently. We currently have about 700,000 tons of it sitting in canisters, primarily in Ohio and Kentucky. And the only use for this material really is used for armor-coated projectiles, weapons. This material, when it explodes, can then pierce through armor. It can pierce through just about anything. And when it explodes, it turns into a toxic dust, very dangerous when inhaled. It causes a large variety of illnesses and probably is the major culprit behind what's become known as Gulf War Syndrome. To the best of my knowledge, the U.S. is the only country that uses this. They were used, I believe, first in the first Gulf War. They were later used some in Serbia in the 1990s, and then they've been widely used in the current Iraq War. That's one of the real key areas where you see a direct link between the commercial nuclear weapons complex and what is going on in Iraq and has gone on elsewhere. The other obvious areas are the weapons production. We now have, for the first time in history, commercial nuclear power plant owned by the Tennessee Valley Authority producing tritium to be used in the construction and placement of nuclear weapons. So again, you have that direct link that didn't used to be there. President Bush has proposed establishing a new program to reprocess nuclear fuel from commercial reactors. And when you do that, not only are you creating new proliferation risks, you end up using a new kind of fuel called MOX, which is a plutonium-based fuel. And there have been various efforts over the last decade to take plutonium from nuclear weapons and turn it into this MOX-type fuel. I mean, in reality, there is no such thing as a peaceful atom, a commercial-only type nuclear program. I mean, a country can do that if it wants, but a country that has nuclear capability on the energy side also, by definition, has nuclear capability on the weapon side. The other big issue is, of course, radioactive waste, and we're expecting in the next couple of weeks for new legislation to be introduced in Congress that will be an effort to overcome the various hurdles that have jumped up at the Yucca Mountain, Nevada project. The Yucca Mountain was chosen in 1987 to be the nation's high-level nuclear waste dump. It has never been able to meet the regulatory guidelines for a nuclear waste dump, and they keep changing the guidelines when problems show up. And even so, it is about 20, 25 years behind schedule, and we're expecting a new legislation to come in and try to sweep away a whole set of problems, prevented progress on that. That's also a very huge issue that actually affects far more the people than just Nevadans, because, of course, to get this waste from where it is, most of which is east of the Mississippi River, to Yucca Mountain requires it to be transported across the country to 43 states and literally hundreds of cities of 100,000 or more, and through America's agricultural heartland. And this transport would pose a number of problems, security problems and accident problems. We call it Mobile Chernobyl. They're looking into whether it will be possible to actually prevent the trains from coming through or not. There's an interstate commerce clause that traditionally has prevented localities from preventing shipments like that through their states. And what we have seen in recent years is a lot of resolutions from various, particularly cities, counties. I know the city of Los Angeles, Denver, St. Louis have passed resolutions against radioactive waste shipment as a means of, A, drawing more attention to the issue, and as a means of trying to pressure Congress members to not vote to approve this type of transport.
That was Michael Mariette, the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Their website is www.nirs.org. Opposes all nuclear weapons research, development, testing, and production, and opposes all nuclear waste dumping on indigenous people's lands. We spoke to Pete Lutzer, who is the executive director of Shundahai Network, and to Marjane Bull Creek, chairperson of the Ongogata Divya, a grassroots group dedicated to fighting the Skull Valley nuclear waste dump.
My name is Pete Lipster. Shundahai Network was founded in 1994. The coalition came together of indigenous and other nuclear disarmament activists under the basic concept that the Nevada test site is located geographically right in the heart of the Western Shoshone Nation, or Nuasogobia, as it's called by the Nuas, the Western Shoshone. And as such, the military, the Department of Energy, has absolutely no right whatsoever under the standing treaty, 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley with the Western Shoshone, to be using the land for that purpose. Also under the principle that it destroys, it contaminates the environment, and it really wreaks havoc on the indigenous communities and all communities that live in that area. There was a movement in Kazakhstan, the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan, where the inland nuclear weapons testing facility that the Soviet Union had used is located. The indigenous inhabitants of Kazakhstan got together, formed an organization where in 1992 called it Nevada, that was organized around the Semipalatinsk nuclear weapons facility in Kazakhstan, and they reached out to the indigenous here in the United States within the Great Basin bioregion to make sort of a transnational indigenous movement for nuclear disarmament. And that's kind of where we got our start in 1994, was through reinforcing the indigenous resistance to the nuclear testing, to the Nevada test site, and to pushing the broader agenda of disarmament, stop testing. We've moved beyond that since into working to stop other nuclear projects, where our concern is with the entire chain, from mining to milling and processing for both power and weapons. And then ultimately, at the end of the nuclear chain, we're concerned about the disproportionate impact that waste dumping has on indigenous communities. And that's where we're at. We're working really hard right now to fight two high-level nuclear waste dumps specifically. One is the Yucca Mountain Project, which is a high-level nuclear waste dump proposed for a site directly adjacent to the weapons testing facility, to the Nevada test site. That would be the only one of its kind in the world, centralized high-level nuclear waste dump with a capacity to hold legally about 68,000 metric tons of waste. The other high-level nuclear waste dump is on the Skull Valley Goshute Reservation. That's proposed as a privately owned temporary facility awaiting the opening of Yucca Mountain. And to that extent, we work with Ongogata Divya Awareness and Marjane Bull Creek to fight that project, which right now is in a very urgent position.
I'm the chairperson for Ongogata Divya, which is, in our language, means a timber-setting community to oppose the high-level nuclear waste, 40,000 metric tons of it, which is designed to come here to our reservation. And in 97, when they issued for the licensing, we formed an organization to oppose it, mainly because of our traditional beliefs as Native Americans and the sacredness we believe that Mother Earth holds for us. 40,000 metric tons is a lot of high-level nuclear waste that shouldn't even be happening. But as Pete mentioned, it's environmental injustice because the nuclear industry has targeted the indigenous lands.
Can you explain the concept of environmental justice and talk about how it applies to your work?
Well, to me, the environmental injustice that I was just talking about is that how this large corporation are targeting our small reservation land to store this poisonous waste. And the reason for that, I believe, is because of our sovereignty issues. It's not going to be regulated by DOE. It'll be by this private facilities. That's why I feel that it's an environmental justice issue.
The concept of environmental justice argues that minority communities, communities of color, disenfranchised communities, Native communities, others, are disproportionately targeted for toxic facilities, whether they're nuclear facilities or other chemical facilities, that in fact it tends to be minority, people of color, and other economically disenfranchised communities that are targeted. The Shundahai Network is a member of a coalition of 17 organizations around the United States. Collectively, it's referred to as BASE. It's an acronym for Building Action for Sustainable Environments. And that's a coalition of organizations representing communities that live within the vicinity and are disproportionately impacted, directly impacted by America's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons operations, as well as other industrial operations that are hazardous to the community. In February of 1994, Bill Clinton signed an executive order ordering all executive branch agencies, that includes the Department of Energy, who manages our nuclear facilities, that in their siting of facilities that could have adverse environmental consequences, extra precaution was to be taken in determining what type of impacts they would have on the most vulnerable communities. These, again, are the minority communities, economically disenfranchised communities, because prior to the signing of that executive order, it was common practice for even federal agencies and a lot of private facilities that in order to open would have to get licenses through the federal or state governments or whatnot to site these hazardous facilities in low-income and minority communities. Since then, there have been lawsuits that have been filed under the principle of environmental justice under this executive order that have been won. There was one, I believe it was in 1995 in Louisiana, where African-American communities were able to successfully sue and stop a nuclear facility, a waste facility, from being set up in their lands. The concept of environmental justice is actually coded into law. It's not just a principle that we're saying, you know, hey, this is not right. It is encoded into law that disadvantaged communities or perceived disadvantaged communities are not to be selectively targeted for these types of facilities. And in the case of the Skull Valley Band of Ghost Shoots, there is evidence that they were selectively targeted because of their perceived vulnerabilities, given the uniqueness of an Indian reservation. Also in the case of the Yucca Mountain Project, that is geographically in the very center of the Western Shoshone Nation, as recognized by the Treaty of Ruby Valley. Under the 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley, the Western Shoshone Nation encompasses five states, including 70% of the state of Nevada, up into the Snake River Basin in Idaho, part of northwestern Utah, and all the way down into the Death Valley and Mojave Desert regions of Southern California. So it's a very large swath of land that is recognized under international law, under a signed agreement the U.S. government made with the Western Shoshone, as Western Shoshone territory that is to be preserved for Western Shoshone people. The Nevada test site is located literally, if you look at the map of Nuasogovia, it is located in the very center of that territory. The Nevada Test Site Nuclear Weapons Facility, over 1,000 full-scale nuclear weapons explosions have been conducted at that. It's the most bombed location on the planet. Directly adjacent to it, again, is Yucca Mountain, which is proposed and is already and still under construction and development as being the world's first centralized nuclear waste repository for the entire nation's reactor fuel from America's 103 nuclear power plants.
Skull Valley is located about 70 miles west of Salt Lake, 40 miles downwind if there's any mishaps. And we're located about 12 miles north of the Digweed Proving Grounds. Our history has it to where the Western Shoshone claim rights and our Goshute Shoshone claim rights are parallel to each other as far as the treaty. Our land was never taken from us, but when they did a claim distribution that meant our tribe, our Band of Goshutes, had given up portion of their land for a dollar an acre. But we still have our small reservation, which is still belongs to the Shoshone.
You're listening to Marjane Bull Creek and Pete Litster.
When we realize that this high-level nuclear waste is going to be coming on a reservation in the name of economic development, when our executive officers at that time thought it may be a benefit to our Band of Goshutes to host this facility. But then when you look beyond that about our indigenous histories, about how our treaties were created to preserve our reservation for the Goshute Shoshone members, and then you look at on how the indigenous people had their plight from the beginning, where we roamed the United States until they start having treaties and put us on small reservations. And this is only a small piece of land that we have, indigenous land that we have. And for us to hold on to our indigenous heritage as long as we have, we still have our beliefs, and some of us still speak our languages. We've held on to our identity as long as we have, and we wanted to continue on with it. The sacredness I spoke of before is important to us as indigenous people. And the other thing is that what's going on with our reservation today is this problem we have with our leadership, where our leadership terms had expired in 2004, and we're unable to hold a valid election. We just had our fifth or sixth election, and it was canceled because we didn't have enough people. And our members are getting fed up to how things are going. And I mentioned today before the people that with our leadership being in question, then how come we're still going on with this contract with PFS?
I could also add that the fight against the Skull Valley Goshute, the proposal for the reservation, private fuel storage, temporary privately owned high-level nuclear waste storage, has been going on now for over 8 years. This year, in February, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, approved the license for PFS to begin moving on this facility. It ended up having to go back because there were some additional contentions that the state of Utah was able to file to block it. They finally just issued a draft license. Was it last week, Marjane?
Yes.
You know, that really heats things up.
Well, our members were told today that it had passed, that the license had been issued, but that's not so. There's still other issues that needs to be dealt with, such as the Bureau of Indian Affairs needs to approve the lease on 820 acres of our land. And then the BLM needs to approve the use of the land to build transfer station to take waste off trucks and move it to the nuclear waste storage site.
They're going to have to move this waste through 43 states, 109 cities with populations over 100,000. And it's as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission process is going through and they continue to rubber stamp these unsafe projects, we're fighting tooth and nail to stop them.
One of the reasons why we're opposing this is that even though they've stated that it's going to be a temporary site for 40 years, it may become permanent because of an accident maybe, and they've stated to us how we've created our own fears, but according to what Pete was saying, I don't think it's fears. I think it's just reality that we need to deal with. President Bush wants to build new power plants. They're talking about maybe building one in southern Utah, so there's no end to this. But I feel that if that's not the federal land, then there's the indigenous land that are going to be promised all this economic development. And we're not benefiting from this. And they're just using the economic development as a banana for us to catch. And it's too bad that other people of our Band of Goshutes are just going for the money, and they're not considering how it could destroy us as being indigenous people. And we do need the public support. Even though it's just going to come to here and be stored here, it's going to come through communities, and that's a big concern.
would like to see the anti-nuclear movement succeed. I mean, we're in an incredibly harsh climate, particularly in the United States, as I see it. The Bush administration is completely committed to nuclear power. But, you know, we're all here. The networks are around, despite the struggles that we're individually facing and that collectively we're completely under the gun of a pretty tightening grip, from illegal surveillance of our activities to, no matter how benign or nonviolent or anything, to, you know, attempts to provoke and disrupt our work. I'd like to see us all get together. I'd like to see us have some kind of unified target that we can focus on. This is one of the things that brought me to Shendai Network, is that what's happening in Western Shoshone and Goshute country right now, I think, is one of the most glaring critiques of the United States government at large. I would like to see the anti-nuclear movement recognize that what's happening within the United States regarding nuclear weapons, nuclear power, nuclear waste issues, lays bare the claims made by the Bush administration for its justifications for going to war overseas. We went into Iraq, for example, on the pretext that they had weapons of mass destruction, that they could possibly develop nuclear weapons. We're looking at going to war in Iran, possibly Syria. We got this tense brinksmanship issue going on with North Korea because they, you know, might have a nuclear weapon. But even when it comes to nuclear power, the Bush administration, the United States government, has a big freak out because they could possibly develop nuclear weapons. Why do you think we even had power in the beginning in the United States? So they could develop weapons. If the anti-nuclear movement could come together and hold the United States accountable by recognizing what's happening in indigenous country, in the United States, when it comes to nuclear issues, I think that that is a sticking point that the entire movement could use to indict the U.S. government.
You can contact Margene Bullcreek at mbullcreek@yahoo.com and Pete Litzter through shundahai.org. Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. We can be contacted through our website, www.circlearadio.org. You can also listen to some of our past shows on that website. We'd again like to thank all of our guests, and if you missed their contact information, we'll be happy to provide it for you. Our next show will be broadcast March 15th at 6 p.m. here on KBOO. Thanks for listening. My only name, but the same.